Well, it feels like it's only been a matter of a few months as I've stood in this pulpit and delivered a gospel meeting. Oh, wait, it only has been a few months. And I'm tickled to be here. When Brother Ken sent me the message inviting me to come and be a part of this effort, it was something I had anticipated before that because I enjoyed a discussion on the eldership while I was here last fall with some of the disciples in this place. I'm excited to be here for this primary reason. Not because I get to deliver a lesson to you, although I do hope things I say this evening will facilitate the process, but because I get to witness the early stages of something that to me is more exciting than going to sit at the hospital with a friend who's having a child or a grandchild being born. We're watching a congregation grow and develop this into the New Testament pattern, into the fullness of the New Testament pattern. And I find that an exciting and encouraging thing, and am happy to be a part of this. There's a second reason why I was so willing to come this far down the river. I also received an invitation to the current household in order to have dinner, and I'd break out of jail to do that. So it's been a good evening for me thus far, and hope that our examination of the Scriptures together will be profitable to all. You've undertaken a great work. You're doing a great thing. And I hope that it continues to be ongoing. What you've decided to do as a congregation is going to help you to keep the instructions or the imperatives of the Lord with regard to the organization of local churches. Luke records for us in Acts the 14th chapter the events while the church was in the process of growing and spreading throughout the region. So when they had appointed elders in every church and prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. In Titus 1 and 5, when Paul instructs Titus with regard to the appointment of elders, he says the following, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you." This is the Lord's will. And folks, if you do the math, if you consider from the historical accounts of the missionary journeys of the Apostle Paul, coordinating the things that you see in the book of Acts, you discover that the congregations in which Paul helped appoint elders and instructed Titus to appoint elders had been in existence for approximately 3 years. That suggests to me, and should to you as well, that in a space of 3 years, honorable men can develop those characteristics to the point that the congregation desires to follow their leadership and appoints them to that service. It should only take that long. Now, granted, there are some exigencies of life that are imposed upon, for example, the family qualifications that will be discussed perhaps at a future time. But when everything's said and done, it should only take about 3 years. It is for that reason, back home at Tomlinson Run, that we've resolved that we're going to do this every fourth year. We allow for 3 years to pass by for men to grow and develop, and then in the fourth year, teach on this subject again and go through the process. There have been occasions where no one was appointed either to the office of elder or deacon. There were times when only one person received an appointment to the office of elder or deacon. But just recently, in fact this past January, we appointed 3 more deacons. I'm convinced that if congregations were to follow the New Testament pattern with regard to this, within a short period of time, they would not only have a qualified stable of elders, they'd also have men in process all the way down to young men who are members of the congregation in process of developing so that the future of that congregation, specifically the future eldership of that congregation, is assured. But more on that a little later in the lesson. This process you've undertaken is going to help you to be scripturally organized. In the Philippian epistle, Paul writes in the first verse, "Paul and Timothy, bondservants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus who are in Philippi, with the bishops and deacons." This specifies for us those groups of persons that you find within a local congregation separated by their roles and responsibilities. Being scripturally organized is the New Testament way, and it's what every congregation should not only desire, but work diligently toward, so that they are not following and using in perpetuity the business meeting system, of which H.E. Phillips commented in his book, it is scripturally unorganized. You want to talk about that? We'll do that after the sermon's over with. This task that you've undertaken is going to make you a more peaceful, productive, healthy, and let me tell you a surprising byproduct, loving congregation when scripturally elders are appointed. Further, it'll help you minimize whatever damage, and you can't always control the situation and shepherd well enough to prevent wolves from coming in. But what you can do is minimize the damage that's caused, both from those who come from within and those who approach from without. Furthermore, having qualified, diligent elders is going to speed your recovery as a congregation when inevitable troubles come. The task you've undertaken will enable you to increase your soundness and your strength as a local congregation. I use soundness not in the classic sense that we do when we talk about being sound in the faith or practicing New Testament doctrine strictly, but rather soundness in the sense of being healthy and sound, being stable in the condition of health. Paul writes in Titus chapter 1, in the context of instructing Titus to appoint elders, holding fast the faithful word as he's been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict. And through the next three verses he continues that discourse. Finally, in this matter, we learn that this work you've undertaken is going to enable you to eliminate the need for the inefficient, ineffective, and potentially dangerous business meeting system. For most of my life in preaching the gospel, and I've been doing so for a little over 35 years, I worked with congregations that use the business meeting system. I have been blessed working at Tomlinson Run, serving under qualified elders for the first 4 years of my time there, and serving as one of the elders for the past 9 years. But suffice it to say that it is a blessing to go into an elder's meeting and to sit down, both as an evangelist earlier on and as an elder in present, and know that all of the men sitting there not only care deeply for one another, but especially care most of all for the well-being of the congregation, the souls that have been put in their charge. It's not always the case in the business meeting system. You have men who are not qualified to be elders engaging in tasks, and I know it's by necessity on occasion, but engaging in tasks that really ought to be the purview of qualified elders. It increases the potential for trouble. I was asked by Brother Kent to speak on the following matters. I was asked to talk about my perspectives on the work of elders. I've given you some of it so far. I was asked to talk about the qualification, is the desire of the office is a qualification, and the qualification of blamelessness, and some things an elder can expect to encounter. But we don't always talk about this when we're studying the work of elders or the need for elders or the qualifications of elders. What are my experiences as an elder? Let me suggest to you that I had no idea before I was appointed to serve as an elder what was going to be involved, at least in terms of the demands on time and effort, on peace of mind and things of that nature. It is not something that you can know ahead of time unless you are very, very close friends with someone who has served as an elder for a long time and been in deep conversation with them. I was appointed to serve as an elder at Tomlinson Run in May of 2003. And I was appointed to serve along with Brother Carl Parsons and Brother Ken Burdine, who were serving as the elders at the time. and appointed at the same time as Gary Burdine, Ron Hennen, and Ralph Baker. I was 43 years old at the time, 43 years old in body, and I like to tell folks I was 25 years old in mind. Now, nearly nine years later, I'm 51 years old in body and about 75 years old in mind. And I smiled at that when I wrote it down too, but you know something? There is a little level of sadness in that because I miss that naivete that I had when I was before I was appointed. I realize that in 9 years, I grew 50 years. It is that kind of experience, brethren. I have never undertaken a more difficult work that has taken more of a toll on my mind and on my spirit. During my lifetime, I've had a lot of jobs, and I've enjoyed every one of them. Some of them were what you would consider less pleasant jobs, and those challenges excited me even more. I one time worked as a foreman in a wood shop that did nothing but hire convicts. Interesting experience. I lasted about 2 years. For the past 35 years, I've worked with 6 congregations as an evangelist. And I've never done a work more demanding or a work that I would consider more important than serving as an elder. And I say this without fear of contradiction from any evangelist who has served as an elder. And we're the guys who would know. You want to compare the work of an evangelist to the work of an elder. The work of an elder is harder. It is more demanding. God bless the men who serve as evangelists alone. I enjoyed those days myself. But God help the men who serve as evangelists and elders because they understand fully how difficult a work it is. I'm not trying to discourage you. That's not my point. Because you're never going to undertake a task that is designed for the well-being of your fellow disciples, that from a worldly perspective is less rewarding, but from a spiritual perspective is more fulfilling. You're going to spend yourself for the well-being of disciples who may not be aware, and in certain cases should not be aware, of the sacrifices you're making. And if you're an honorable man, you won't whine about them. In fact, you may be making sacrifices on behalf of folks who might not even appreciate what you give of yourself, even if they did know. But short of giving your life physically for Jesus Christ, you'll never perform a higher service for the Lord and for those little sheep that He places in your care than when you serve them as an elder. Let's begin talking about the questions I was specifically asked. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. Desires. There is so much laid up in that word. It comes from the Greek word eregomai, to stretch oneself, to reach out after, to long for. Simply desire. The person who is desiring the work or the office of an elder could have either good or bad intentions or motives. And I believe that the Apostle Paul, when he begins that text with the faithful saying, is assuming that the person who desires the office of an elder in this context has the best of intentions. That he is an honorable person and he does not desire the office for any unworthy motives. I believe that it's best to begin with the word desire in our consideration of this matter, because what one desires or purposes to do on a voluntary basis is more highly esteemed not only by the Lord but by others as well than what he does when he is asked to do it. Simple illustration, that of the house of Stephanus. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 15, Paul writes, I urge you, brethren, that you know the house of Stephanus. That's an imperative, folks. He's telling them, get to know these people. That you know the house of Stephanus, that it is the first fruits of Achaia, that they have devoted themselves to the ministry of the saints. Paul highly esteemed this individual and various other ones he commended in the closing comments of his epistles. Those volunteers who step forward to fill those roles, it ought to be the desire of every Christian man in his youth to develop these qualities and to become an elder when he matures. Young folks, you want to ask the question, why do I need to worry about being this kind of person while I'm young? I need to enjoy myself. Because this process of preparing yourself to become an elder doesn't begin the day the congregation decides, well, we need some men to appoint. It starts when you're young and takes a lifetime to develop those characteristics and qualities. In fact, if you look at the 22 qualifications that you find listed in the combined texts of 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 to 7, and Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through 9, you will discover that 18 of them are characteristics all Christian men should have. All Christian men. No wonder it was relatively easy in 3 years from the time Paul helped begin those congregations until he instructed Titus to appoint elders, that they had men ready to do that. Because these were men who realized their characteristics, 18 of them, ought to be part of every Christian man's life. If a man desires the position or the office of an elder, do you know there's no Greek word for elder? You aware of that? When I began this study and considered the question of is desiring the office a qualification some years ago, it didn't occur to me that office isn't a Greek word. And there isn't a word actually in it for the Greek. It's a phrase. And the phrase literally translates as the ministry or the service. You're talking about someone who is interested not in a position or not in some sort of power, but he's interested in service to others. In fact, it is not a position of legislative or executive authority. You want to define the office, if we can use that word, of elder? It's a stewardship. It is God placing into our care and responsibility others who need to be overseen and taken care of. That is why I said that 18 of the 22 characteristics ought to be behavioral habits of all Christian men. We should be working on these things and developing these things, whether we have intentions of one day becoming an elder or not. It's critical. In fact, if you consider, and I'll throw this one in for free, if you consider the remaining four, only one of the remaining four has anything to do with talent or ability, and that's apt to teach. And I submit to you that that can be cultivated or developed. Of the remaining three, one of them has somewhat to do with age. Folks, unfortunately, that comes to everybody. You don't get to stop that one. I don't even know why he listed that as a qualification, because we all get old quick. I'm being facetious. The only two that have a tendency, if I can say so, the only two that can have an impact are those two family qualifications. And those, if one works diligently at them, can do much to bring those in line and in order early in life. We're working for a stewardship. We're working to become actually more like Jesus. And it's also, as I said a moment ago, it is not something where we are going to acquire power and begin to dictate or legislate to others how things are going to be done. When you consider the two texts that are instructive regarding the work of elders, you see within the instructions that it's not a crack the whip type thing, but rather it is a walk out in front and guide and lead. In 1 Peter chapter 5, beginning at 2, Peter writes, "Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive crown glory that does not fade away. I don't see anything in there about power. I see responsibility. In Acts 20 and 28, consider it from this context of the discussion. Therefore, take heed to yourselves and to all the flock, among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. I am certain in your own studies, especially with regard to the names given to elders, that of shepherds and bishops and pastors and so forth, all of the names that are given to elders are names that do not imply power, but rather connote stewardship and responsibility. When you desire to do the work of an elder, you desire a good thing. And it is work. And we're not going to lie about that. New International Version calls this work a noble task. I think that's an interesting way of translating an almost untranslatable phrase. But it's right. It is a noble task. It's work. It will be something over which you'll lose sleep for weeks over church problems. And it's pressure. You're going to be constantly aware of the responsibility of the souls placed in your care. And when some matter comes up, whereas in the past we had a tendency to, oh my, grumble a little bit about this and hope somebody takes care of it, now suddenly you're the guy to take care of it. You and two or three other or four or five other men in whom the congregation has placed confidence for leadership in this matter. It's pressure, and you'll be aware of it. It doesn't go away. Even in those moments when you're joking and laughing. I stood in the back there this evening and had a good laugh with some friends I haven't seen in a while. Joked about Brother Dan. That's easy to do. Sorry about that. But at the same time, I was fully aware of not only the responsibility here of presenting the truth on this matter, but of going back home this week, this evening in fact, and beginning early tomorrow morning addressing the matters of the congregation that came up yesterday and this morning that need to be dealt with. It never goes away. And it's the closest you're going to come to the sacrifice of our Lord. And I suggest to you that you will help your brethren in proportion to the amount you sacrifice. But is it a qualification? I believe it was Brother Kent I was talking with, and that's what generated the interest in this question here. I seldom have had opportunity to talk about this. In fact, as recently as 2002, it was part of my own notes when I taught on the subject of the eldership. There were 23 qualifications until I realized I'm trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. It's not a qualification. It's what we call a logical fallacy. It is a leap of logic that we make that we think makes sense but really isn't accurate. The fallacy is technically called false categorical imperative, sometimes called false categorical necessity. And I'm sure you'll remember that next week whenever the series of meeting is over with. Suffice it to say, it is a logical mistake. We include it in the list of qualification because if it appears similar, therefore it must be the same. And that's not true. Let me give you an illustration. Suppose Brother Steve decided that he wants to go and preach in India, which incidentally right now is open to gospel preachers coming in and teaching the native preachers how to spread the gospel. Steve wants to go to India to preach. And he inquires of disciples who have already been there. He says, what do I need to do? What kinds of things do I need to have in place? What qualifications are there for a preacher who wants to go over to India to evangelize? And the response comes back to him, well, Steve, if you want to go to India to preach, you must have the ability to preach, have a passport and visa, get enough support, and have a contact to India. desire to go to India is a false categorical imperative. He already wants to go to India. That's already in place. That's not a qualification. That defines Steve. Likewise with the eldership. Paul's not talking to the men who don't desire the work. He's talking to men who desire the work. The qualifications necessarily follow. You say, well, that's a distinction without a difference. No, it's not. It's accurately, grammatically, and logically correct. But Brother Blake, I really seem to fit the rest of the qualifications. It's just I don't have a desire to do that. Or I'm afraid I won't be able to do well. You know what? We include that because in our time, very few brethren want to do the work. I think the Apostle Paul was assuming that good men are going to want to do this work. But in our time, very few of what we would consider good men make the effort to engage the work. And I would include those men who seem to meet the qualifications of verses 2 through 7 of 1 Timothy 3 or Titus chapter 1 verses 5 through 8. But they excuse themselves from it. Or they deflect the pressure from others who ask them to serve. And they do so by saying they're not qualified because they do not desire the office. I make no apology for saying this. I'll talk to you about it afterward. I think they should be honest and just say, I'm spiritually lazy or I'm morally cowardly. Because it isn't about qualifications. The problem is at the core of the individual. And you would say, well, doesn't that disqualify him? Not based on the qualifications. In fact, I would suggest that that puts him in risk of not gaining a home in heaven. Because when God blesses us with the ability, and God blesses us with the opportunity, and God blesses us with the apparent responsibility, and we say no, I would hate to respond to the Almighty on the day of judgment were I in that position. The second instruction I was given was to consider the matter of blamelessness, according to the King James Version, or without reproach, as it is in other translations. Blamelessness comes from an unpronounceable Greek word that literally means cannot be laid hold of, inculpable or unrebukable. It's in a negative form, the way the word is constructed. And in the negative form, it simply means that blame or harm or evil cannot be attributed to such a one. Does that mean that he doesn't do anything wrong ever? Or has never done anything wrong? I would say that Jesus Christ would be the only one to whom that could be stated in affirmative. No, what it means is that a man who is blameless is one who lives in such a way that charges of wrongdoing are not going to be believable because they seem clearly out of character for such a one. Or they cannot be reliably proven because they're stated by someone who's a name for dishonesty or has a bad reputation otherwise. This is without reproach. The Holy Spirit does not require that an elder be above sin, but that he correct his sins as God instructs him to do so. In 1 John chapter 1, verses 6 to 10, John includes himself. Look at the pronouns. John includes himself as an apostle, as an inspired writer. He includes himself among those who need to acknowledge to the Lord when they stumble and fall. He did not exclude himself, and of course did not exclude elders from this. This is the scriptural response to it. It does not mean sinless. It means without reproach. It means that he has a good name. It means that there's nothing in his life that an enemy can use against him to ruin his influence. It means that when he has ought against someone or knows that someone has ought against him, he goes to that individual and they address the matter the way Christians address the matter. That's what it means. I don't think it's an accident that this is one of the first qualifications listed. I think there's a good reason for it, because it strikes me as I read the rest of the qualifications that a number of them seem to hang on this one, seem to be outgrowths of this characteristic. There is a natural flow to the qualifications, and blamelessness comes first. An elder is defined by his integrity, and that integrity earns for him a great deal of respect and confidence in him from the congregation. It is something that he earns by a lifetime of godly works, by establishing in the recent memory of the disciples a pattern of honorable behavior, an honest behavior. It's not something that he can demand or require others to give him. How foolish it would be for me to say to someone who disagrees with me or has an issue with me, "You just mind your own business. I'm an elder." We have presidents that did that and didn't get away with it, and rightfully so. Blameless means he doesn't behave in such a way, or rather he behaves in such a way that charges against him are considered foolish. We run into a problem, however. With this one, as well as with the remaining 21, some folks turn the 22 characteristics of elders that you see in those two accounts into the 22 disqualifications by establishing somewhat arbitrary standards. Let me illustrate my point. Apt to teach, what does that mean? What level are you going to raise that to? Apt to teach, does that mean that he needs to be as deep in knowledge as a Bob Waldron or as articulate as D. Bowman? Were that the case, I wouldn't be speaking here tonight. Think about it. I'm not saying that they're relative. I'm saying that they are the measure of the man, and do not impose upon them a standard the divine did not do or imply in the text. About the matter of blamelessness, are you going to go back and consider the mistakes that he made and repented of and brought forth fruits that measure repentance some 20 years ago? Not a novice. How old does he need to be? I was 43 years old when I was appointed. Brother Parsons was 52 when he was appointed. Should I have waited till I was 52? How about hospitable? You're going to discuss at some point in this study the matter of hospitality. How hospitable does it mean? Does it mean that he must have guests in his home every day of the week? Does he have to have guests every Sunday? How often does he need to exercise hospitality? The answer to these questions are relatively simple. The extent to which every man has these characteristics will vary from one man to another. And his aptness or appropriateness for the work in a given congregation will also vary from one congregation to another. A man who is apt to teach in one congregation may not be capable of teaching in another one. When I was appointed, I didn't have the qualities of an elder to the same extent as Brother Carl Parsons, who was 85 years old at the time and had been an elder for 40 years. There was a period of time when his wife passed away from cancer that he ceased to serve as an elder, but when he remarried a godly widow, he was reappointed. Total of 45 years. I wasn't as qualified as Carl. Does that mean that I should have said, "No, please pass over him, or pass over me"? I guess what I'm saying, folks, is don't elevate the standard to the point that no man qualifies. I think some folks might elevate the standard to the point where even Peter wouldn't qualify. And I find, and again, another matter I'm not going to apologize for. In my own experience, most men who do that, who elevate the standard to where honorable folks in any given local congregation would not qualify to serve in their estimation, do so because they're not qualified themselves or may never become qualified. and are unwilling to submit to a leadership that does not include them. How are we going to apply this? What are we going to do with this? Both of these matters are critical in doing the work of an elder. You need to strongly desire to be a servant of the Lord, strongly desire to be a servant of your brethren, and have that desire in a selfless, sacrificial way. Otherwise, you're not going to be motivated to do the work well. And you're never going to be without the need to have a reputation for integrity and honor, blameless. You may find that to be the best help, the best tool in your arsenal as you serve the Lord as an elder. Within 6 months of being appointed in May of 2003, the elders at Tomlinson Run had to deal with a neighboring congregation that was involved. Some of the members were involved in a whisper campaign against the newly appointed elders because they believed that they were not qualified. To which my response would be, what business is it yours? This is a local autonomous congregation. We sat in a room with 25 men from three different congregations for 2 hours answering their charges. Being blameless on the part of all six of us meant that their charges were unfounded. It was based on speculation. Between 2006 and 2010, at Tomlinson Run, one elder passed away. One elder resigned due to age and health. One elder was appointed. And one elder went rogue and led away a small faction of about 25 people. We went from enjoying the leadership of six elders with the combined experience of 95 years to four elders with a combined experience of 21 years in a short period of time. Imagine dealing with that. Imagine dealing with an elder gone rogue, who one day gets irritated with some of the members, and because he's one of the elders, he makes demands that are unreasonable regardless of who asks. And if I don't get my way, we're taking off. That'll keep you up at night. We've been through some serious church-dividing crises on a yearly basis. Went through a time when five elders invited discipline persons to a party for all the members and tried to keep it a secret from me because I was away on vacation. And then, when they realized their error, five of them stood before the congregation and made their acknowledgments. When did you ever see that happen or hear of it? I'm going to tell you, after each one of these crises were handled, I can be honest without any fear of the Almighty at this moment and say that what happened in Acts when the church dealt with crises then happened at home, and the church grew and multiplied. Four men and one woman confessed to being addicted to porn. Can you imagine a man that you're considering, who has been a Bible class teacher for years, and you're considering asking him to serve as a deacon, come to you, or have his wife come to you, actually, and say, I need you to talk to my husband. He's constantly, on a nightly basis, looking at pornography on the internet. What do you do? There's nothing you can do in a Bible study about the eldership and the qualifications to prepare for that. That comes from desire to be a servant of the Lord and of the disciples. That comes from integrity. You don't get experience in a Bible class or even in a series of lessons of this nature, although you're to be commended for having them. You get it by doing the work. Incidentally, and I'll throw this one in for free too, are you aware that based on some studies by some brethren, I believe Brother Steve Wolfgang is involved in it, Jason Harden has done some of it, and a few others who are denominational Bible students, that among the men who profess to be spiritually minded, 1 in 3 view pornography on a regular basis, and of the women who profess to be spiritually minded are Christians, 1 in 5 do? If you're going to serve as elders, that's something you would consider. If you're not going to have elders here, teaching on that should be something you would consider. That's the little dirty secret that most congregations don't want to know about. We've dealt with 6 disciplinary actions, 3 public internet attacks on the congregation, the elders, and the preacher, a neighboring congregation within the past few years charging us with stealing sheep, on and on. One of the things, I believe it was Brother Aaron who asked me on the phone when we were talking about this upcoming lesson, and wanted to know, well, why don't you just tell us about the most difficult question you were ever had to deal with as an elder? And the answer to that is the next one. That's the hard question. Because you can't anticipate it. The only thing you can do is trust the Lord and His pattern for the local church. My heart goes out and my prayers go up for congregations that are unwilling to organize in a New Testament way and appoint qualified men to be elders. By the grace of God, we have come through those trials with the church growing in love, in faith, and in numbers. And while the credit goes to the Almighty, and to the disciples there who are spiritually minded in heart and love one another with all their might, I believe in part it is because the elders consider their service to be the most important work they will ever do, because the elders love the souls in their charge and are extremely protective of them, and because the elders resolve to work together harmoniously regardless of the issue. We could not do this without the strong desire to serve those we love, nor could we carry out this task without the integrity that attaches itself to being blameless. Take out your hymnals, please, and turn to the song our brother has selected for invitation. I love anti-heroes. You know what an anti-hero is? It's not somebody who's against heroism. It's somebody who doesn't want to be a hero. It's my favorite character in whatever genre I'm involved in, whether I'm reading a book or watching a movie. I like the character who's probably curmudgeonly. He's probably unwilling and reluctant. And he's probably deeply flawed himself. That's the character I like, who is called upon to do the task. It's easy to identify with such a one. I'm old enough to know that there are no knights in shining armor up on white horses. I know there are no sheriffs in cowtowns wearing white hats and taking out his silver gun and shooting Black Bart and all the rustlers. Those don't exist. Those are stories. In real life, the heroes aren't the ones with the white hats or the shining armor. The ones who have no flaws, and when you see them after riding out in the dusty desert, their mustache is elegantly curled. They're the ones who really don't think they're qualified to do the task. Really at heart, know that they have their own issues and problems to deal with. They're conflicted. When the Lord called Gideon, Gideon was more than reluctant. He rebuffed the call. He was doing something strange. Threshing grain in a wine press. That's the last place on the planet you would want to do that task. But he had to do so in order to hide it from the enemies. I want you to come and be a leader of the people. Are you kidding me? and he demanded two tests of the Lord to demonstrate the Lord was actually with him. David was called to be a leader of God's people. Sin with Bathsheba, engaged in a conspiracy to commit murder. Peter was summoned to be an apostle of the Lord. And when it came time to stand around the campfire and warm his hands while Jesus was up under trial, they said, "I think you were with him. You look familiar." "No, not me." "I'm sure it was you. You're one of his disciples." "Not me." And he began to curse and swear. These were the ones that the Lord had called to do his work. Flawed characters, reluctant to do it. But when it came down to cases, they performed admirably. Not because of any inherent quality in them, but because of what God saw in them. That these were persons who were more than salvageable. These were persons who could be used to his greater glory. I suggest to you that there are no white hats in this room. There's no shining armor, white horses, or silver guns. Every last one of us is dealing with a problem or an issue. But the Lord has confidence in us. Such confidence that not that we're salvageable, but that we can become effective servants in His kingdom and bring glory to His name and to the name of His Son. The question is, will we step up and accept what the Lord believes of us? It is by means of the gospel of Jesus Christ that we begin the process whereby we grow into the person that God sees we're capable of becoming. It is by living faithfully as a Christian that we grow and develop in our service to the Lord till we accomplish things that looking back on it in reflection at the close of life, we're heroic in nature. Obey the gospel. Be a faithful Christian. You'll be an anti-hero in this world and saved in the world to come. Answer the call of the gospel, please, by coming forward while we stand and sing. Jesus the Lord.